much older then. I'm younger than that now.
Welcome into Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton. You know, I saw a study recently that made me want to talk about the thing that no one really wants to talk about. But it is the thing that we all need to talk about because 97% of those with mild cognitive impairment, or MCI, are undiagnosed. And tragically, most are unwilling to get tested because they fear an Alzheimer's diagnosis. And of course, MCI doesn't necessarily lead to or indicate Alzheimer's, but it can. And not wanting to know as early as possible is like not wanting to know if you have cancer as early as possible. Recent research has revealed that Alzheimer's can begin to occur and can be detected almost 2 decades before the onset of any symptoms. And the good news is that there are now new FDA-approved drugs that can slow its progression. The great news is that lifestyle modification has been proven conclusively to have the ability to prevent as many as 90% of all Alzheimer's cases. So let me say that again. The key to preserving our brain health and preventing Alzheimer's is lifestyle, something we all have control over, which is why I'm excited and grateful for the opportunity to speak today with one of the world's most respected brain health doctors, researchers, and scientists. Dr. Dean Sherzai is a behavioral neurologist. He holds 2 master's degrees in advanced sciences. He's got a PhD in healthcare leadership. He is the co-director of the renowned Alzheimer's Prevention Program at Loma Linda University. And by the way, the other co-director is his equally renowned wife, Dr. Aisha Sherzai. The Sherzais have authored 2 best-selling books, The Alzheimer's Solution and The 30-Day Alzheimer's Solution. They co-host the podcast, Your Brain On. And together, they lead the largest community-based brain health initiative in the entire country. They have helped literally tens of thousands of patients, from the partially cognitive impaired to those who are suffering from Alzheimer's, find hope through personal lifestyle intervention. So let's welcome the brain doc, Dr. Dean Sherzai. Doc, how you doing today?
Thank you so much. Thank you for the kind introduction. And we're so excited to be here. This is our life pursuit. My wife and I met 20 years ago, 21 years ago, and got married 20 years ago around this concept. Both of us had 2 grandparents that suffered from this, 2 amazing human beings, which we saw lose bits and pieces of their memories and themselves to this disease. So it has become a pursuit. It has become a passion project. And to that end, we are very protective of this field and research in general to make sure that things are not exaggerated and obfuscated, because people's hopes depend on this. I know for a fact that I was watching my grandfather, who was a brilliant man, lose bits of his own self, and he was so desperate. And there are people out there that are actually abusing that desperation, that need, that want, that hope. So this is a battle for people's minds. But the positive side of this is that a significant portion of dementias in general, dementia is the umbrella category, right? It's multiple types of dementia. And Alzheimer's, which is a major type, about 70% of all dementias, can be prevented. And that's incredibly positive hope and that we can build our lives around.
And you mentioned the push to say the incredible, the thing that people want to hear. And I think this is one of the challenges that we all face, those who are at least trying to facilitate the conversation, is that, people know that there is no cure, or they think there might be a cure. And some people in medical professions want to say that maybe there is a cure. But what we do know is there is hope. Have you ever been pushed, doctor, by your publishers, by others, to exaggerate what's happening in the space?
All the time, and the pressure is so massive. When we first published our first book, there was hints that if you just hint at the fact that you could reverse Alzheimer's, that you would sell millions of extra books. And nobody holds you accountable. Look what's going on in social media. People making all kinds of claims, and nobody pushes you, and making up studies. And now the danger is that doctors are actually making up studies, which are not really overseen properly, and then they get published and they get on TV. And but all we had to do was hint, because we were at the epicenter of that research, right? We left UCSD, the number one neuroscience program in the country, to not go to, you know, Boston or some, you know, San Francisco, to one of the big universities, but go to Loma Linda, because we realized early on that there is signal. There is some signal, significant signal, that lifestyle can massively alter the disease, but not reverse the disease. So we couldn't make that statement. We said we can't. There's the, when people are coming to you, they're coming with their hope. And the, as a doctor, it's actually not don't do harm or do good. It's actually make sure that you preserve the hope of people properly, and making sure that you speak to it properly. And to exaggerate like that is criminal. And there are many that are doing that now. And we will not, because I've done the work on the pathology of the brain once Alzheimer's has set in. I know what happens to the tau protein and its infectious nature that's actually unstoppable. Early on, yes. At the MCI stage, yes. Definitely pre-MCI, absolutely. We actually went as far as to say, under absolute optimal conditions, we think that as much as 90% of dementias can be prevented, but definitely 60% has been proven. But as much as 90%, if you do all optimal, and we've defined the optimal. And the optimal is not, you know, finding the holes in your system and filling it with some vitamin concoctions. It's not that. It's simple lifestyle factors that one can start inculcating, incorporating into your life. And they are meaningful. They are profound. And we saw the difference in populations that were a mile apart in Loma Linda, the Seventh-day Adventist, versus a mile away in San Bernardino, where the prevalence of dementia and vascular disease was much greater than in Loma Linda.
You really are uniquely geographically located, because, you know, for those folks who don't know, Loma Linda is one of five blue zones in the entire world, geographical areas that have a higher incidence of healthy longevity. And it's not exclusively Seventh-day Adventists, but it is a large population of Seventh-day Adventists. And of course, doctor, they're known for, you know, plant-based diets and socialization and spirit. Is that why you went there? Because you knew that's where you could uncover what you were looking for?
Yeah, when we were at UCSD, like I said, at the time, they were the number one neuroscience program in the country. When we came back from Afghanistan, we looked around and said, where is the best place? And Leonthal, which was the preeminent neuroscientist doing work on brain health in general, but especially Alzheimer's, he was there. I called him. I said, I want to come and work with you. We came there and did fMRI work and pathology work. And while there, we realized that there are clinical trial after clinical trial after clinical trial that were failing. And by the way, my next words is not against pharmaceutical. There will be some drugs that will do amazing things. And there are drugs that do amazing things for blood pressure and cholesterol, all that. So we are not the type of doctors that, again, throw the baby out with the bathwater. There is a place for medication, but lifestyle must be 80% of public health. But it's not. It doesn't exist, because there's no financial remuneration. There's no reward. There's no payment. So lifestyle falls to the side. And it's only pharmacy. And that's not going to fix things. There has to be a lifestyle component. So while at UCSD, doing all this work, we were looking around and saw this amazing scientist, Elizabeth Barrett Conner, that name by itself, you know, more than 850 publications. She was one of the remarkable scientists that had done the work on Rancho Bernardo, looking at effect of lifestyle on all kinds of diseases. And she had shown some signal that cognitive health was affected positively as well with lifestyle. And then many other doctors that opened our eyes and started looking for data. And repeatedly, we would see that there was plenty of meaningful, valid, and robust data that showed lifestyle has an effect on not just on heart disease and everything else, but on brain health. So we decided to look for, again, the path less traveled. I looked around and said, you know, I'm not going to go to a big institution and follow the system, which I support. And I think that there are a lot of amazing people doing amazing, great work in clinical trials and all that, which should happen. but that wasn't my journey. And we decided to go to one of the only blue zones that has been validated, by the way, especially lately and within the last few months. There's some data that the only one that's been validated is actually Loma Linda or the Seventh-day Adventist. The rest, the data is a little murky, but the ones in Loma Linda has a study that's been going on for more than 50 years, over 97,000 people involved, data captured properly and well. And so we said, we're going to go there. So I picked up the phone, called the president of the university, cold call, and said, you know, this is my background. I want to come and build a brain health center here. Can I come? And he said, absolutely. But I said, I need 2 days, no pay. I don't need pay to do community work. And they said, okay. So we came. Aisha did another fellowship in residency in preventive medicine. And we finished our work and started collecting data and looked into the community. And what we saw was just mind-blowing. Among my 3,000 patients that came after 5 years of working there, we collected data that had dementia. You expected 1/3 of the population to be of a particular lifestyle. The Seventh-day Adventists are mostly vegetarian, plant-based. They walk a lot. They're community-centered and faith-centered. So we expected, nonetheless, because 1/3 of that city, which has a higher proclivity for Loma Linda, because Seventh-day Adventists would come to their own hospital, Loma Linda, at least 1/3, given the population distribution, to be of that type of population. But lo and behold, out of the 3,000, we only found 19 individuals that had dementia, that had a plant-based lifestyle, and had all these other variables of lifestyle. So we immediately realized that lifestyle had a profound effect. At the same time, we did half a day of this clinic, community clinic in San Bernardino, and young people would come in with headaches, with blood pressure, with memory loss in their 40s and 50s, and we would do MRIs, and you would see white matter disease in brains of people in their 40s and 50s, and you would see cognitive decline in their 40s and 50s. And I think that disparity has truly not been recorded properly, that lifestyle has that much of an effect. Forget about the improvement part, the decline part. And the more we looked, we realized that blood pressure differences, which are massive between the two populations of healthy and non-healthy, are a big contributor. Cholesterol, specifically LDL, is a big contributor. Diabetes and pre-diabetes, big contributor. So all of the, and then of course, hearing loss and everything else. So we realized that lifestyle has a profound effect. And then it's around that time that some other studies came that showed that as much as 60%, and even in suboptimal lifestyle interventions, as much as 60%. And with diets like Mind Diet, which is not even the optimal, 53% reduction in MCIs transitioning to Alzheimer's. These are massive numbers. Why isn't everybody speaking about this? Because it means that people have to change lifestyles. But it's not as hard as that. You really don't have to do all or none. For transparency's sake, my wife and I are whole food plant-based. But you don't have to be whole food plant-based. We showed that every positive step you take reduces your risk significantly. So we have a lot of hope to changing public health with that kind of a perspective, as opposed to a binary or a shocking perspective.
A voice of reason and perspective when we all really need one. You know, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. A little bit of positive daily lifestyle choices can go a long way to improving our overall health and well-being. When we return in just a moment, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Dean Sherzai, co-director of the renowned Alzheimer's Prevention Program at Loma Linda University. This is Growing Bolder.
Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for our latest stories and motivational pictures.
Welcome back to Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton. We're speaking today with Dr. Dean Sherzai, one of the world's preeminent authorities on brain health. And of course, we all have a family health history. I asked Dr. Sherzai if we can overcome even a strong genetic predisposition for neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, and multiple sclerosis.
Beautiful question. So let me just talk about the genetics. Genes have to do with penetrance. Penetrance means how much of your outcome is determined by a gene. Yes, some of those diseases you noted are 100% penetrant genes driven. Huntington's disease. If you have that abnormal gene on chromosome 4, where this protein that's called CAG repeats is created, if we test that, even in your 20s, and you have that abnormality on chromosome 4, it's 100% chance that in your 30s, you're going to start manifesting the symptoms. So yes, certain diseases have 100% penetrant genes. Even frontotemporal lobe dementia, a major proportion of it is driven by a higher penetrance genes, meaning much more likely that the gene will manifest. Yes, lifestyle will affect it a bit, but genes will manifest. For Alzheimer's, there's now pretty good evidence that only 3%, 3 to 5% of all Alzheimer's is driven by 100% penetrant genes. 3 to 5%. The rest is driven by polygenetic, epigenetic phenomenon, meaning that genes that have some risk, it's a group of 40 to 50 genes, probably more as it will manifest, and they are risk genes. It's an interaction between those genes and environment, lifestyle, and everything else. The second highest penetrance genes is APOE4. Yes, for that one, if you have one gene from one parent, your risk goes up 4 times. If you have two genes, one from each parent, your risk goes up 12 times. But even in that population, lifestyle has an effect, meaning that if you do certain things, your risk goes down significantly lower. And the clue is in the function of that gene. That gene produces a protein that is function, main function, there are many functions, but main function is lipid transport, fat transport. So there's the clue. If you're a bad fat transporter and your diet is full of fat or has lots of saturated fat, then it's going to affect you negatively. And there's a story with omega-3 as well, which we'll get to later. So for Alzheimer's and several other diseases, genes have an effect, but lifestyle has a greater effect. For Huntington's, it's all genes. But Huntington's is not a very prevalent disease, whereas Alzheimer's is affecting more nearly 7 million people in the United States and more than 45 million people worldwide that's been identified. It's actually a bigger number than that. And we can influence all of them through lifestyle.
And you say, doctor, a good place to start, because this is the question everybody's thinking now, a good place to start to have a positive impact on your brain health is through nutrition. Why do you say that, and where do we begin? What's the most important thing we might be able to do?
A good place to start is actually where you need to start for two reasons. It's the Venn diagrams, where your deficit is, right, and where your opportunity is. That's how all decisions should be made. The Venn diagram of opportunity, resources, and outcome, right? So if you have sleep apnea, that's where you start. Sleep apnea has been shown to significantly increase the risk of dementia. So if you're snoring a lot, or if you're sleeping 7 to 8 hours and still are tired, or you're moving throughout the night, or you know, lots of other signs, go get tested. It's a treatable thing. Yes, the device is an instrument of torture, but you'll get used to it. And now we're developing better and better devices. By the way, don't buy into fake cures. Go to a legitimate university-based sleep facility because there are many different kinds of approach to it. But sleep apnea is something treatable and get it done. But if your deficit is in nutrition, that's where you start. But if your deficit is across the board, actually, I would say start with exercise. If you want to change behavior, you want to change behavior in a way where it's sticky and easy. And you can build and crystallize and build on that base behavior. And nothing gives you response, signal, and outcome better than exercise. And by exercise, I don't mean go run the marathon. Starts with a brisk walk or even a slow walk, 20 minutes. and slowly build it, slowly but methodically and measurably, build it up to 25 minutes of brisk walk a day. Just that has been shown to significantly reduce your chance of dementia. Why exercise? Because exercise is easier. Exercise you can do in your own room. I tell people, if you have no space, do you watch a show? Yes. Stand in front of that show, and during that show, do steps. And then from there, you can build the next, and the next pyramid. So now all of them have an effect, including what we call neuro. It's a little self-serving acronym that we've coined and we've trademarked. It's N for nutrition, E for exercise, U for unwind, good stress and bad stress. Yes, good stress. We'll talk about that. R for restorative sleep, not just knocking yourself out with medication, but restorative sleep. You have to go through 4 to 5 cycles of deep sleep every night. That's where the only cleanse that exists happens, during sleep. And fifth one, O, is optimizing mental activity. Continually challenge your brain. That's the only thing that grows the connections between your neurons, in the order of 30,000 per neuron. So where you start is where your deficit is, where the opportunity lies, and where you want to go. So that. Let's talk about nutrition. Of course, nutrition is important. This is an environmental factor that your body deals with 3 to 5 times a day. Everything you eat can build or break your brain on a daily basis. It can create one of the four horsemen: inflammation, oxidation, glucose dysregulation, and lipid dysregulation. What affects all four of those? Food. Oxidizers, inflammatory or anti-inflammatory, glucose regulation or dysregulation, and lipid, which is fat regulation or dysregulation. By the way, any one of those paths can get you towards dementia, and affecting them together moves you away from dementia. So nutrition is critically important, and everything you put in your body will affect you that way. Now, you don't have to feel guilty, but you have to have a systematic way of improving diet, because it's incredibly effective in reducing the four damaging factors, not just to your brain, but to your whole entire body.
You know, I think, Doc, one of the frustrations we all have is that we have conflicting reports, you know, even coming out of the medical profession all the time. Coffee's good for us, it's bad for us. Red wine's good, bad. You know, there's so many things that we're unclear about, even those who want to make the right decisions. When it comes to oils, because we hear a lot about that, butter, margarine, olive oil, peanut oil, avocado oil, what should we be using? Is oil okay, and what kind's the best?
I say that the journey of human evolution is comfort with complexity. The thing that gives me seizures and triggers me is when people say common sense. Common sense is silencing of conversation. Don't ever silence conversation. Anything that makes conversation propagate more complexity, even if it doesn't come to fruition, it's okay. That's the whole point of you having 87 billion neurons and 1 quadrillion connections. I promise you, it's not for you to find a mate and find the next meal. Bacteria do that better than you. It's to build complexity of thought, complexity of understanding. Now, that doesn't mean it has to be paralyzing. With nutrition, when it comes to fat, there's a little bit of complexity. It's a three-dimensional chess. If you don't have calorie problems, meaning that you're not trying to lose weight, then there is good fat and bad fat. Saturated fat is bad. Trans fat and hydrogenated fats are bad. That's been proven when on social media people come and show you one little petri dish study or animal study versus thousands of studies, massive studies, the Harvard study, the Framingham study, the California teacher study, 133,000 people, the Adventist study, 97,000 people. I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on, as well as ward studies, meaning that people were brought into a room, followed for 2 weeks of what went in and what went out. That level of study, everything shows saturated fat is bad. Period. There's no question. So we are bewildered. How is it that somebody who comes in and says, oh, eat red meat and it's going to heal you, where there's no data, no meaningful data? You can find data that somebody published that, you know, eating a can of aluminum is going to cure you from diseases because there's 100,000 papers published a year. But robust, validated, reproduced data? No. There's the reproduced data, the valid data, the ones that's been robust, large databases that have been overseen by others, third parties that have no proclivities, one or shows saturated fat is bad. Lower your LDL. That's been shown. This whole talk that, oh, your body needs cholesterol. These are people that don't know that your body already makes cholesterol. You don't need to pump it in with cholesterol. So that's doesn't even come close. We did a multiple series in our podcast, Your Brain On, with world-renowned people on saturated fat, on protein, on sugar, multiple people per talk. And the data is just replete. There's no question. And nobody's hiding. There's no conspiracy. There's no sugar conspiracy or fat conspiracy. There's data. Data is data. And then there's robust data. Yeah, you bring me a Petri dish study where you put some cells and you put drops of something on it and it grew or it didn't grow, does not equate to humans. To speak to that, 400 studies on mice showed that the given intervention cured them of Alzheimer's. None of them were translated to humans. So just because it worked on a Petri dish, let alone a mice, doesn't mean it's going to work on humans. So it's critical that we know where the data is coming, how robust it is, how much reproducible it is. And that's what's happening. That's the phase of humanity we're in. Getting comfortable with complexity of data. That's where we are. There's fights. There's going to be, we think that this noise is so loud. Nope. It's going to quiet down with reason and with people getting comfortable with complexity of data. And that's beautiful. I'm not worried. I'm a very optimistic person. Now, when it comes to food, sugar is bad, but carbs are not bad because the preferred method of energy acquisition, which is if you look at the pathway, is a complex system for glucose, is glucose, but not in bulk amounts, in slow release as it happens with carbs. And so that's the way to look at the complexity. With fats, if you don't have caloric restriction, polyunsaturated fats are fine and it's been actually been shown to be good. And there are now evidence of anti-inflammatory factors. The quantity has not been determined because that's a fourth level complexity. Quantity depends on you and your variables and all that. But at least it's not as harmful that they used to say. Now, if you have a caloric issues, yes. 1 teaspoon of olive oil, extra virgin olive, still is nearly 150 to 250 calories. So that should be taken in consideration. But if you don't have caloric issues, it's not a problem. So we have to take that level of complexity. And then we get to not just avoiding everything. An old method for humanity is to solve things is to negate it. Don't eat at all. Don't eat this stuff. Don't eat this stuff. Well, that doesn't work for population level public health. We really have to see what works for the given population is by reducing saturated fat, increasing vegetables, reducing sugar, simple carbs. Fiber and carbs are good. So complex carbs. And that's it. You don't have to worry about what kind of diet, mind diet, vegan diet, plant-based diet, whole food diet, a keto diet. More plants, less saturated fat, less simple sugars, and more unprocessed. And just by doing that, you will profoundly change your lifestyle, not just for your brain, which is the hungriest of all organs. This little 3-pound organ, 2% of your body's weight, consumes 25% of your body's energy. It does some of its best work at night where everything else is asleep. So you really have to worry about what you're giving it. And what you should be giving it is more plants, less saturated fat, less simple sugars, less processed.
That is Dr. Dean Sherzai, a guy who follows the data. You know, as we've all learned, one of the many downsides to social media is that it gives every voice a platform, and there are many voices out there that spread nothing but untruths, which can be not just frustrating, but devastating when it comes to our health. Dr. Sherzai is a data-driven academic, and when we return, I ask him about conflicting reports on the efficacy and effectiveness of statins.
So sign up for the Growing Boulder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingboulder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Boulder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingboulder.com/podcasts.
In a soldier's stance, I aim my hand at the mongrel dogs you teach.
Welcome back to Growing Boulder. I'm Mark Middleton. Let's wrap up our conversation now with Dr. Dean Scherzi with two questions we get asked a lot. What about statins? Should they be as widely prescribed as they are? And what about supplements? Are they key to healthy aging or just a waste of money?
My favorite term, which we, in our household, we have two teenagers, we have painted all the walls with whiteboard so you can write on the walls. One is do not extrapolate beyond the data, which is what you see all the time everywhere. And that's important. The second is to the best of our knowledge today. And I think that's the only humble term in our planet today. It's a scientific term. To the best of our knowledge today. The best of our knowledge today is not failure. To the best of our knowledge today has gotten us to the moon. The best of knowledge today has gotten us into space. To the best of our knowledge today has moved our life expectancy from 38 to 78. You know, to the best of our knowledge today, the controversy is not there. The data might change, but at this point, there really isn't that much controversy when it comes to saturated fat, when it comes to lipids. We know that LDL has to be now less than 70 for people at risk, for those that have no cardiovascular risk, less than 100. And we have to go with those data because the data that we're quoting from are from large databases that have been repeated. People have been followed, not just some social media guy that then went to his basement and just came up with something and said, oh, you know what? I'm smart. I'm going to say this. And then my followers must follow. So the data so far shows that LDL is the thing to focus on at this point. The data shows that. As far as cholesterol-lowering medicine, there was a period that there was worry that it actually might have caused cognitive decline. But that data was looked at pretty aggressively, and there was no signal that it has a negative effect. In fact, the opposite. The latest data on large databases show those at risk, would mean that those have high cholesterol, who are treated actually have lower risk of dementia and strokes and things of that nature. So that's where the data is now, and that's the data that's robust, repeatable, and that's what we have to go by. The controversy comes when somebody who was previously in some lab in Stanford or Harvard makes a big statement and then everybody says, oh, that Harvard professor said this. I always tell people when I give talks, we're keynote speakers in ACLM this year and other places, do not make icons of anybody, especially Aisha and I. The only thing you should value is the next thing coming out of my mouth based on data, robust data, and repeatable data, meaning that others have repeated it and shown validity as well. If it comes out of opinion, I should say, this is my extrapolation. You can do with it as you may, but it has very low weight. If it comes out of personal experience, it's just anecdote. An anecdote is the first step to a multi-chain step of validity. My migraines were cured when I went plant-based. I never say that because at the same time, I also got married to Aisha. So there's a confound there and multiple other confounds. One case does not mean anything except the first step to a series of validation. And so that's the way we should approach things. And I think that's the knowledge that's actually promulgating and spreading in society. People are becoming comfortable with rejecting icons, including us. Do you see all these degrees? Meaningless. If the next thing coming out of my mouth is a bombastic thing that is not supported with multiple references that have been repeated by others with valid, robust data. And even then, as I've said, to the best of our knowledge today. If we as a society learn this and get rid of icons and get familiar with data and how to truly decipher data, then we have saved the planet because then it becomes a process where everybody gets involved in data-driven improvement of the world around us.
Dr. Dean Sherzai, telling it like it is. And, you know, you mentioned icon, and maybe this is an iconic study that I shouldn't mention, but we're talking about lifestyle and how lifestyle modification can prevent up to 90% of all Alzheimer's. And we've talked about diet. We've talked about nutrition. There is a thought is coalescing around the idea that social connection is critically important. And the Harvard adult study of social connection, I probably got the name wrong, one of the longest longitudinal studies ever, has determined that the key to active longevity, one of the leading causes of all-cause mortality, is low social interaction. How important is that to maintaining a healthy brain, Doc?
Oh, that's so important. And I'll explain it this way. Multiple variables that deal with cognitive activity are driven by that engine. So when you're cognitively active, there are two things that actually grow neurons, not neurons. The number of neurons don't change that much as you get older. Yeah, there's controversy. Yeah, do you grow new neurons or you don't? It's not that important. You have 87 billion neurons. Even if you lose 7 billion, not at once, that's bad, that's catastrophic. But over time, what happens to the other 80 billion matters. Each of those neurons have been shown to make just a couple of connections or as many as 30,000 connections. In fact, now we know that certain cells, the Purkinje cells in your cerebellum, can make as many as 50,000 connections. Do the math. That's power. And that is in your control. It's under your control. Though that connectivity is dependent on several things. So the nutrition, if you have bad nutrition, it actually affects the baseline and it doesn't allow the growth. If you have poor sleep, it actually starts decaying the connections and breaking it up. And we'll talk about sleep. If you have stress, it starts breaking it down through the limbic, hypothalamic, pituitary system, as well as the sympathetic system. But the thing that grows the connections is two things. One is exercise. Study after study showed that brains actually grew specific areas of the brain, the hippocampus for memory and the prefrontal cortex grew with exercise. And the other one is mental activity. So mental activity is good stress. Remember I said good stress and bad stress? Your brain wants to be stressed. Your brain doesn't want to sit on the beach all the time. No matter how much you think that it does, it doesn't. If it's not being challenged, it actually withdraws and pulls back those connections and starts shrinking, especially as you get older. You don't want that because that shrinkage becomes accelerated. Yes, take some time on the beach, but push your brain around your purpose, around meaningful things, around meaningful conversations. That is what pushes the brain to make the connections. Now, nothing does that better than social connection. Now, Sudoku is great. I'm not against Sudoku. Crosswords are great. Those have been shown to be helpful. But conversations with people of meaning to you, around topics that have meaning to you, that are pushing conversations in different directions, involve all of your brain. They involve every aspect of your brain around your limbic system, which is your emotional brain. Your limbic system is a social being. I call it a social being, as though it's a separate being, because it's your emotional brain. It's who you are. So nothing affects that more than social activity. Then, of course, with social activity comes cognitive activity. With social activity comes emotional resilience. With social activity comes movement. With social activity, hopefully, comes good eating as opposed to bad eating. With social activity, all of those things can be connected together. I think it's the most important of all values. And then the population studies from Japan, but from Okinawa and other places and many, many other places, as well as the Harvard study, the longest study in the world, more than 80 years, showed that the one variable that stood out the most as far as longevity and vitality was the nature of your connections. So really invest on those connections. Those connections matter. Those connections are not just conversations. Those connections are exponential connections within the neurons of this amazing brain. Those connections are movement. Those connections are value. Those connections are purpose. Those connections are everything.
If you will, as we say goodbye, can you give us a quick hit list? And I know, Doc, you probably mentioned all of these things in our conversation, but share with us, if you will, 3, 4, 5 things that you think we can all do starting today to improve our lifestyle, to diminish the possibility that we will, in fact, have cognitive decline.
Don't follow any dietary patterns if you don't want to, but with diet, increase your greens. Although I'm not about superfoods, I think it's food patterns, but the studies showed that people who ate more greens, spinach and other greens, dark leafy greens, their brains were 11 years younger. I don't even believe those kind of data, but the data is so robust that it's significantly. So increase your vegetables, especially dark leafy greens. Reduce your saturated fat, reduce your simple sugars, but in a measurable way. We all say it, but then we fall back to baseline. Do it measurably. This day, I'm not going to have saturated fat and I'm not going to have sugar. That's measurable. That's retainable. That's great. So that's it. That's nutrition. Move throughout the day. Watch 2 of your shows while standing up and doing steps in place. Not fast, just steps or just standing. Do a few squats. Leg strength meant bigger brains. You don't have to go to a gym. Do mini squats while watching a show. Bigger legs protect you in many ways. And walk 25 minutes of brisk walk. Work your way to 25 minutes of brisk walk in a measurable way. 45% reduction in dementia from MCI to dementia by people who did brisk walks and build leg strength. 2 things. That's it. Stress management. Build life around good stress. Don't get lazy. Take classes. Learn new musical instrument. Learn new music. Learn to dance. And reduce the stressors by identifying them and then systematically reducing them. Sleep. Invest in your sleep. There's a reason that you're knocked out, paralyzed for 8 hours for tigers, bears, and you know all these animals to do whatever they wanted to you, because sleep is that important for cleansing your brain. There is no other cleanse. Sleep is the ultimate cleanse, which means invest in your sleep, create a positive space, lower the sound, lower the light, don't have a lot of light right before sleep. And we talk about this quite a bit in our podcast, Your Brain on the different things you can do to improve sleep. And sleep hygiene is critical. And lastly, build your brain around purpose. The O part. Optimize cognitive activity around social activities such as volunteering, joining groups, learning, taking classes with groups, learning a musical instrument, joining bands, or just learning new things, but in a social setting. That's powerful. That makes the connection. That creates idea density. And the combination of just these few things is so powerful. That's my advice.
Some great advice from Dr. Dean Sherzai. And you can learn more about The Brain Docs, their books, and their podcast at thebraindocs.com. Let's take another dip into the archive for a GB classic. You know, it was back in 1992 at the age of 55, strictly on an impulse, that Werner Berger, with zero previous hiking or climbing experience, trekked into the Everest base camp area with his son. And that trip totally changed his life. He fell in love with the majesty of the mountains, with trekking and with climbing. And at age 69, he became the oldest North American at the time to summit Mount Everest, which, of course, is the highest mountain in the world. And then at 77, he became the oldest person in the world to complete the 7 Summits Challenge, which is reaching the summit of the highest mountain on each of the 7 continents. And that's a record that still stands to this day. We spoke with Werner not long after setting that record, and let's pick that interview up with Werner explaining why he climbs.
Partly because of the exhilaration, definitely because of the sense of beingness when I'm in that space. And what I mean by that is I cannot be on a mountain without being completely in the present. Some people talk about it as living in the now. And when I'm in that space, there really is an alteration in who I am being. Everything around me is so much more beautiful, so much more elegant. So, yeah, the words actually escape me. And it's a sense of humility and this phenomenal grandeur. And I know I'm using a lot of adjectives, but those are the thoughts, those are the feelings that accompany the climbing. And then, of course, the exhilaration in getting to the top is amazing as well. There are so many learning opportunities from being on a mountain. One of them is simply how phenomenal our bodies are and how much more we can do than we think we can do. So it really is an exploration of self.
To do what you do at any age is phenomenal. To do it in your late 70s is beyond that. It's remarkable. What is your secret? I read somewhere that you're an advocate of high-quality nutritional supplements. Can you tell us what you take, what works, what you believe in?
Yes, and just before I do that, I don't really believe that what I do is phenomenal, because it really isn't. There are so many people that are fitter than I that could be doing this if they had the vision or the desire to do it. Relative to supplementation, I learned that our foods are nutritionally depleted and we simply cannot get what our bodies need any longer from just eating even good foods. So I supplement with a multivitamin, but not one that I just buy off retail shelves, because usually the quantities or the potency isn't enough, the combination isn't enough. So multivitamins, very definitely antioxidants, addition of omega-3 fatty acids in terms of fish oil. And then I usually have a shake in the morning as breakfast, as opposed to, you know, the regular breakfast of milk and eggs and toast and whatever.
Most of us are intrigued by guys like you, because most of us, you know, we want to live in our comfort zones. We're not willing to take, you know, really any risk. And especially as we age, it gets harder. You're a big proponent of stepping outside our comfort zone, of not saying someday I'll do this. What do you say to inspire people to take action? What works when it comes to trying to get people off the couch and into life?
People have to keep dreaming. They have to keep inspiring themselves to follow up on their bucket list, as opposed to capitulate to the belief that, oh, I'm too old to do that, or only young people do that. And, of course, the minute people stop dreaming, they really become relegated to their couches or their rocking chairs, which is really unfortunate.
Werner is still dreaming and still climbing. And, you know, he likes to say that everybody has an Everest in their life, not a mountain, but a challenge that inspires them, but also scares them. And his encouragement to all of us is simply to go for it. Up next, a word of encouragement from our own Cecily Wilson. This is Growing Bolder.
Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for our latest stories and motivational pictures.
One of the keys to life is to keep moving forward. Moving forward is a path that leads us to new adventures and memorable experiences. Moving forward allows us to keep growing, to keep learning. But things happen to us all that slow us down and threaten to stop us right in our tracks. Hi, I'm Cecily Wilson, author, journalist, and stroke survivor. I learned firsthand how difficult the simple act of moving forward can be. But I'm here to tell you, not only can you do it, you really have to. When we stop moving forward, we stop living. The only way to start is to begin to shed yourself of all the things weighing you down. Sometimes it's our own self-doubt, our own fears. I get it. It's much easier to do nothing, to just isolate and hide away from the world. But we only get one life, And it's worth every bit of the struggle to begin to shed whatever weights are holding you down. For me, it helps to put things into categories. I call it the three P's. If things in your life don't bring you peace, purpose, or profit, then they're probably just holding you down. Shed them and see how wonderful life can once again be once you begin to move forward. Because that's growing bolder.
Thank you for that, Sess. You know, we all need encouragement, which is why we all need to be encouragers. We're all in this together, and the facts are clear. Life is filled with challenges, and how we respond, how we bounce back, how we keep moving forward will determine to a large extent our future health and our happiness. Are we simply growing older and letting the challenges of life keep us down, or are we growing bolder and allowing the challenges of life to make us stronger, more resilient, and more grateful? We'll see you next time.
The Growing Bolder Radio Show is a production of Growing Bolder, LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Bolder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis, and our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.